Chapter 17 of The Bandit of Hell's Bend by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 17 The Black Coyote. With the coming of morning, Diana Hender's mind had, to some extent at least, emerged from the chaos of conflicting emotions that had obstructed reasonable consideration of her plans for the immediate future. It had been her intention to ride forthwith to Hendersville and confront Corson and Lillian with the proofs of their perfidy, but now saner reflection counseled more rational procedure. The law now was all upon her side, the proofs were all in her hands. It was beyond their power to harm her. She would continue in the even tenor of her ways, directing the affairs of the ranch and mine as though they did not exist. When they made a move, she would be prepared to meet it. She spent an hour before breakfast in the office writing diligently, and then she sent for Texas Pete. When he arrived, she handed him an envelope. "Take this to Aldea, Pete," she said, "and mail it on the first eastbound train. I can't trust to the stage. It is held up too often. And, Pete, I am sending you because I know that I can trust you to get to Aldea as quickly as you can without letting anything interfere. It means a great deal to me, Pete." "I'll get it there," said Texas Pete, and she knew that he would. 10 minutes later, she glanced through the doorway of the kitchen, where she was talking with Wong, and saw a cloud of dust streaking swiftly northward towards Hell's Bend Pass, across country in an airline. Roads and trails were not for such as Texas Pete when speed was paramount. The day, occupied by the normal duties of the ranch, passed without unusual incident. There was no word from Corson. The next day came, brought Texas Pete back from Aldea, and went its way with the infinite procession of other yesterdays, and still no word from Corson. By this time Diana was about convinced that the New Yorker, appreciating what the theft of his letter must mean to him, had abandoned his scheme, and that doubtless the stage had arrived in Hendersville today and would carry him and his accomplice back to Aldea in an eastbound train. Her mind was occupied with such satisfactory imaginings that morning when the office doorway was darkened by the figure of a man. Looking up, she saw Gum Smith standing with hat in hand. "Mornin', miss," he greeted her. Diana nodded, wondering what Gum Smith could be doing on the Bar Y, a place where he had always been notoriously unwelcome.
"I've come on a most unpleasant duty, miss," he explained. "As sheriff of this year county, it's my duty to serve you all with notice to vacate this property by noon tomorrow, as the rightful and lawful owners wishes to occupy same."
"You mean Mr. Corson and Miss Mantle?" inquired Diana, sweetly.
"Yes, miss, and they hopes they won't be no trouble. They's willing to do the right thing by you if you moves off peaceable like and pronto."
"Would you mind taking a note to Mr. Corson for me?" she asked. "I think I can convince him that he is making a mistake."
Gum Smith would be glad to accommodate her. He said so, but he also advised her, as a friend of her father, to make preparations for an early departure, since Mr. Corson's patience was exhausted, and he had determined to take drastic action to possess himself of the ranch as Miss Mantle's agent. When Mr. Morris B. Corson read that note an hour later, he swore in a most unseemly manner. He did not divulge its contents to the Wainwrights, but he went into executive session with Gum Smith and Hal Colby, from which he did not emerge for an hour. A short time later, the sheriff, accompanied by a dozen deputies, rode out of Hendersville, and sometime thereafter, Corson, Lillian Mantle, and the Wainwrights drove off in the latter's buckboard which Diana had sent in to them the morning after their hasty departure from the Bar Y. The ranch was deserted that afternoon, except for a couple of laborers, the white cook at the cookhouse and Wong at the residence. Texas Pete and his vaqueros were spread over a vast principality occupied with the various duties of their calling. Idaho had been left at home, in accordance with time-honored custom, to act as bodyguard for Diana should she wish to ride abroad, which she had wished to do, and they were both off to the southeast somewhere, in the direction of the Johnson Ranch. It was a lazy afternoon. The air vibrated with heat. But in one corner of the kitchen, far from the stove, which was now out, there was a cool corner, or rather, one less like inferno. Here stood a long table that had once graced the dining room, and upon it, at full length, supine, lay Wong, asleep, his long pipe with its tiny brass bowl still clutched in one depending hand. He was aroused by the sound of voices in the front of the house. He opened his eyes, sat up, and listened. There was a woman's voice among those of men, but it was not the voice of Mlissy Dly. Wong arose and walked toward the office. He stopped where he could observe the interior without being observed. His slanting oriental eyes narrowed at what he saw. There were Corson and Miss Mantle, the two Wainwrights and Gum Smith. Corson was going through Elias Hender's desk as though it belonged to him. Presently, after having examined many papers, he evidently found what he wanted, for there was a look of relief upon his face as he stuffed them into an inside pocket of his coat after a superficial glance. The elder Wainwright was continually glancing out the doorway with an air of extreme nervousness. "You think it's perfectly safe, Sheriff?" he demanded. "Of course it is, Wainwright," snapped Corson. "We've got the law on our side, I tell you, and enough men out there to back it up. As soon as her men find we mean business, they won't bother us as long as she isn't here to egg them on. And most of them would just as soon work for us anyway when they find Colby is coming back as foreman. A lot of them are his friends." "I don't see why Colby didn't come along with us now," grumbled Wainwright. He wanted to wait until we were settled in our ownership, and then we could hire whom we pleased as foreman, said Corson. I see how he feels about it, and it will help to make him stronger with the men and with the neighbors if he hasn't taken any part in the eviction. It'll be better for us in the long run, for we are going to need all the friends we can get in the county. I'm afraid we are, agreed Wainwright. I hope you will fire that Texas Pete and the ones they call Shorty in Idaho the very first thing you do. I don't like 'em.
That's about the first thing I intend doing just as soon as they get in, replied Corson.
Just now we better look up that damned insolent chink and tell him how many are going to be here for dinner or supper or whatever they call it out here.
Wong tiptoed silently and swiftly to the kitchen, where Lillian Mantle found him a moment later and imparted her orders to him.
An hour later, Texas Pete rode into the ranch yard with his men. He was met at the corrals by a fellow he recognized as an habitué of Gum's place, one Ward by name.
"Evenin'," said Ward.
"Evenin'," said Texas Pete. "What in hell are you doing here, Ward?"
"They wants you, Shorty, and Idaho up at the office."
"Who wants us?"
"Miss Henders and the people she's sold out to."
"Sold out, hell," exclaimed Pete.
"Go on up and ask 'em."
"I sure will. Come on, Shorty."
"Idaho must be around the bunkhouse somewheres."
The two men started for the office. At the bunkhouse they looked for Idaho, but he was not there, so they went on without him. As they approached the house, they saw three men lolling on the veranda outside the office door. They were not Bar Y men. Inside, they saw Corson sitting at the desk. He motioned them to enter.
"Come in, boys," he said pleasantly. As they entered, the three men behind them rose and drew their six guns, and at the same instant, three others just within the office covered them with theirs.
"Put 'em up," they were advised, and Texas Pete and Shorty, being men of discretion, put them up. While they had them up, one of the gentlemen in their rear relieved them of their weapons. "Now look here, boys," said Corson, not unpleasantly. "We have no quarrel with you, and we don't want any, but you're rather quick with your guns, and we took this means of ensuring an amicable interview. Mr. Wainwright, Miss Mantle, and I are now owners of the Bar Y Ranch. Miss Henders, realizing that she had no claim, has vacated the premises and turned them over to us. We shall not need your services any longer. We shall give you a month's wages and escort you as far as town, where your weapons will be turned over to you. But I want to warn you that you are not to return to the Bar Y. If you do, I shall see that the law takes its full course with you."
"Where's Miss Henders?" demanded Texas Pete.
"She has left the ranch," replied Corson. "I do not know her exact plans, but I think she went directly to Aldea to take the train for the east."
"I don't know her exact plans neither," said Texas Pete, "but I know you are a damn liar. You got the drop on me and Shorty, and we goes to town as you says, but if the rest that you've told us ain't straight, we coming back again. And when we do, it's going to be gosh almighty unpleasant for dudes in these parts. Savvy?"
"If you show your faces around here again, you'll be shot on sight," said Corson. "We've got the men and the money to run this ranch as we see fit, and we mean business. The old disgraceful lawless days are about over in this county, and there won't be any place for bad men like you two."
"No, Pete," said Shorty. "We're did for. Our time's up. They ain't no more place for us in a jackrabbit. We're going to have a new brand of bad men now, the kind they raise in New York that wears funny pants and robs orphans."
"Take 'em to town, boys," said Corson, addressing his own men. "And then come back here. You've all got jobs here on the Bar Y, and one of the first duties you have is to shoot bad men on sight if they show up around the ranch." Texas Pete and Shorty turned and walked out with their escort, and shortly after, still under guard, were loping away in the direction of Hendersville. The stage came down the pass with a load of passengers that day, and among them was a lawyer from Aldea imported by Corson and Wainwright to draw up the papers that would make one-third of the Bar Y property Wainwright's and place $125,000 in the hands of Corson and Lillian Mantle. At the mine road, it stopped and took on the messenger with the bullion. Then, to the crack of Bill Gatlin's whip, it lurched onward toward the gap. Bill was discoursing to a tenderfoot who had remarked on the dry appearance of the country that he had seen, stretching as far away as the eye could reach from the summit of the pass.
"I should hate to be caught out there alone," said the young man. "I'm afraid I'd starve to death."
"Why, that wouldn't be nothing," observed Bill. "That wouldn't be nothing at all. Why, back in the 70s, when I was riding for the Lazy H outfit in Montana, I was chasing a critter one day when my pony stepped in a badger hole, and after turning three complete somersaults, lights plumb on his feet and starts off across country scared stiff, which would have been all right if it hadn't have been that the last somersault chucked me clean out in the saddle. And by cracky, it was just my darn luck that my foot caught in the stirrup, and that ornery critter up and drags me. He was so scared that he never much more and slowed up for 3 days. Yes, sir, he drug me for 3 days and nights, and all I had to eat was when he drug me through a strawberry patch, and all I had to drink was when he drug me through a river. No, sir, after that it wouldn't seem bad at all to be left out nowheres in no country."
The tenderfoot looked at Bill with deep and reverent awe, but he said nothing. The stage bumped over the uneven road, lurching drunkenly around curves. A masked man waited silently behind the boulders at the south end of the gap. He appeared nervous, turning often to glance back into the chaparral from which he had emerged a few moments before. "I wonder where in hell Gregorio is," he muttered, half aloud. "He told me last night that he would be here before me." The stage drew nearer. Bill Gatlin reined his team to a walk at the first deep chuck hole at the entrance to the gap. The horses moved slowly, picking their way and sometimes stumbling in the deep, dust-filled cavities that made this short stretch of scarce 50 yards the most notorious piece of road within 100 miles. The lone highwayman could wait no longer for his accomplice. He must essay the thing alone. He stepped forward to intercept the slow-moving stage, and as he did so, a noise behind him attracted his attention, and a single backward glance revealed to him a masked man and the familiar habiliments of Gregorio. He breathed a quick sigh of relief, motioned to his accomplice to hurry, and moved forward with the second man now close at his heels. Bill Gatlin and the messenger were not surprised when the two men stepped into the middle of the gap and held them up. They would not have been surprised under ordinary circumstances, but today they had been forewarned that there would doubtless be an attempted hold-up on account of the unusually valuable gold shipment, which was being used as a lure to trap the Black Coyote. And they had been warned to offer no resistance, since Hal Colby had agreed to take the notorious robber if the matter was left entirely in his hands without any interference whatsoever. All of which pleased Bill Gatlin and the messenger immensely, since it relieved them both of most of the danger and all the responsibility. Not only did Bill Gatlin show no surprise at the appearance of the two masked figures, but, as a matter of fact, he was already stopping his team as they appeared, and had his hands in the air almost as soon as the command left the lips of the foremost of them. As usual, the Mexican kept the driver and the messenger covered while the Black Coyote approached the stage to obtain the gold, but this time the second robber followed his principal more closely than had formerly been his custom. The coyote menaced the passengers with his weapons, seeing that they kept their hands elevated, and then with Gregorio on the watch behind him, he slipped both his guns back into their holsters and reached up to take the bags of gold away from the messenger. He had placed one foot on the hub of the front wheel to raise himself to a height that would enable him to reach the precious pouches when his confederate stepped quickly toward him, shoved the muzzles of his guns into the Black Coyote's back, and ordered him to put up his hands. "Step down and put 'em up," he said. "You're through."
"Durn my hide," exclaimed Bill Gatlin. "Hal's pretty cute. I thought he was Gregorio all the time. He's got bull to rights this time."
The Black Coyote stepped back from the stage with a growl. "You dirty greaser, you," he cried. "I'll get you for this yet, Gregorio." The latter nodded to the messenger. "Get down and get his guns," he said, and when the man had done so, "Now, yank off his mask." The messenger jerked the black silk handkerchief from the face of the Black Coyote with a single quick movement, and then stepped back suddenly, his eyes wide with surprise.
"Colby," he ejaculated.
Bill Gatlin almost swallowed his quid of tobacco.
"Well, I'll be hornswoggled," he exclaimed, and then to the second robber. "And you was Gregorio all the time, and I mistook you for Colby. The joke sure is on me, and the drinks, too."
"They are," agreed the second robber. He shoved one of his guns into its holster and removed his own mask.
"Well, now I will be hornswoggled," murmured Bill Gatlin, "if it ain't Bull."
"Keep him covered," said Bull to the messenger, "while I get our horses." Colby glared sullenly at Bull as the latter walked back up the road to get the horses, but he said nothing. He was still half-dazed from the surprise of seeing Bull disguised as Gregorio, for even to the latter's guns, Bull wore the entire outfit of the Mexican. And when Bull returned, riding Gregorio's and leading Colby's animal, the Black Coyote eyed him as though he still doubted his identity. Bull drew rein beside him and nodded toward Colby's horse. "Climb aboard," he said. Colby mounted, and Bull tossed the noose of his riata around the prisoner's neck, drawing up the slack until the Honda touched the collar of the man's shirt. "Pull your freight, Colby," said Bull, and the two started off down the road toward Hendersville. A moment later, the stage passed them.
"Want me to stay along with you in case you need any help?" called Bill Gatlin.
"I won't want no help," said Bull. As the stage drew away from them, concealing itself in its own dust, a swarthy rider galloped up to Bull and Colby, reining in a blaze-faced chestnut beside them. It was Gregorio. Colby glared at the Mexican.
You, he shouted.
"Shut up, Colby," Bull interrupted him. "You got what was coming to you. It'll learn you not to ditch a pal." Gregorio had dismounted and was stripping off his outer garments, and Bull followed his example. As they exchanged clothing and horses, they joked together over the day's work, which they considered good. Gregorio swung himself into his saddle first.
"Adios, Señor Bull," he cried, with a wave of his hand. "Perhaps in a few days Gregorio comes out of the hills, eh?"
"I'll fix that up when I get through with this business, Gregorio," replied the American. "In the meantime, just lay low."
"And I will work with you for the Barway Rancho?"
inquired the Mexican.
"If I do, Gregorio,
so long.
Adios, Señor."
And Gregorio wheeled his pony back toward the hills.
"That greaser's whiter than some white men," said Bull.
When he trotted into Hendersville a few minutes behind the stage, he found that already the news had spread, and a crowd, gathered about the stage in front of the Donovan house, surrounded him and his prisoner.
"Durn his hide," exclaimed one who had been foremost among the posse that had ridden forth to hang Bull only a short time before. "I knew right along 'twarn't Bull. I allus said there was something shady about that there Colby feller."
Bull had but just drawn rein when Texas Pete and Shorty rode up, safely delivered in town by their escort, and having reclaimed their guns, which had been emptied of cartridges and dropped in the road at the edge of town while the escort galloped quickly out of range toward the Bar Y. Texas Pete had no time for questions. His quick eyes took in the scene at a glance, and possibly he guessed the explanation, or caught it from the comments of the crowd. but another and more important matter occupied his thoughts as he forced his pony to Bull's side.
"Have you saw anything of Miss Dye?" he asked. "Is she here in town?"
"I don't know. Why?"
"She ain't on the bar. Why?" "Corson said she's sold out and left for Aldea," replied Texas Pete.
"Corson's a liar," snapped Bull.
He turned toward the veranda of the Donovan house, where he espied the proprietress.
"Mrs. Donovan," he called to her. "Is Miss Henders in town?"
"She is not, Bull," replied Mary Donovan.
Bull turned his eyes toward the crowd until they alighted upon a man he knew who bore a decent reputation, one who was not affiliated with Gum Smith or his gang.
"Thompson," he called, "you take Colby and keep him till I get back. Don't let Gum Smith get his hands on him, and shoot Colby if he makes any funny plays. Get down off on your horse, Colby. Take him, Thompson. Come on, boys."
And with Texas Pete and Shorty at his pony's heels, he started on a run for the Bar Y. As they raced along, now neck and neck, Texas Pete jerked his head back in the general direction of Hendersville.
"What was it all about?" he inquired.
"I just runned it up the Black Coyote," replied Bull.
"Colby?"
Bull nodded.
"I've been suspicioning him," he said, "for a long time back, but I couldn't ever call the turn on him. Then I runs into Gregorio while I'm hiding out up Coyote Canyon. Him and Colby been working together all along, but it seems lately that greasers found out that Colby's planning on double-crossing him and going south with all the swag. This was to be the last job, and Colby fixed it some way to have a big shipment of gold today, so Gregorio and me fixes it and swaps clothes and horses, and I takes the greaser's place. Colby never got onto it at all. He thinks I was the greaser plumb up to the minute I yanks off the mask."
"I thought Gregorio didn't have no use for you, Bull," said Shorty. "I done him a good turn a spell back."
That was all he said about the fight with the Apaches in Cottonwood Canyon, where he had risked his life to save the Mexicans. They rode on in silence for a while. The ranch buildings, nestling among their trees, were visible in the distance when Texas Pete called attention to a speck among the sagebrush far to the southeast. To an untrained eye, it was scarcely appreciable.
"There's a saddled cayuse," he said. "What fur is it doing out yonder?"
Bull strained his eyes in the direction of the animal.
"Looks like the yellow sorrel Idaho used to ride," he said.
"Idaho was left home with Miss Dye," said Pete. As one man, the three reined toward the distant pony, and with loosened reins tore over the powdery earth, bounding in and out and over the brush like so many nimble-footed jackrabbits. Blazes, outdistancing the other ponies, reached the yellow sorrel first. Bull threw himself from his saddle and kneeled beside the prostrate form of a man, half hidden in the brush. It was Idaho. As Bull lifted his head, he opened his eyes. He looked at Bull in a bewildered way for a moment, the expression of his face denoting a concentrated effort to recall his mental faculties. Then Texas Pete and Shorty reined in beside him in a cloud of dust and profanity.
"Where's the boss?" demanded Pete.
"What you loafing out here for?" inquired Shorty.
Slowly Idaho sat up, assisted by Bull. He looked at the reins looped about his wrist. He felt of his side and brought his hand away covered with blood.
"I done the best I could," he said, "but there was too many of them."
"Where's the boss, you ornery sidewinder?" yelled Texas Pete.
"Who's them? What have they done with her?"
"They was all masked," said Idaho. "I didn't know no more after they creased me. I don't know what they done with her. Help me aboard that cayuse, you bow-legged flannel mouth, and we'll pull our freight and find her, instead of sitting around here listening to your yap."
Pete, who had dismounted, helped Idaho, almost tenderly, into the saddle. "You better beat it for town," he said.
"You ain't much good, nohow, and with a 45 between your ribs, you ain't no good whatsomever."
"Shut up," Idaho admonished him. "If I was perforated like a salt cellar, I'd be worth two of you."
He reeled a little in the saddle, but shook himself and straightened up. It was evident that he was weak from shock and loss of blood, and that he was suffering pain beside.
"You better go back, Idaho," said Bull. "You ain't in no shape to ride at all, and I reckon we got some hard riding ahead of us."
"Go back, you damn fool," said Texas Pete, who, under the cloak of rough and almost brutal badinage, had sought to hide his real concern for his friend's welfare.
"Go chase yourselves," replied Idaho. "I'm going with you."
They wasted no more time in argument, but started riding a wide circle, looking for the tracks of the abductors. They found sufficient evidence to convince them that there had been upward of a dozen horsemen concerned in the work, which corroborated Idaho's statement, and that approximately half of these had ridden directly in the direction of the Bar Y, while the others had taken a southerly route. It was the latter trail they elected to follow after Bull discovered upon it the imprint of an iron shoe, and as Captain, being tender in front, had recently had his 4 feet shod, it was safe to assume that they had taken Diana Henders this way. They rode fast, for dusk was already on them, and when, a short time later, it became too dark to distinguish the trail from the saddle, they were often compelled to stop and dismount, and upon several occasions, strike matches to make sure that they were still on the right track. Their progress was, therefore, necessarily slow. Toward midnight, they lost the trail completely. It was there they left Idaho, too weak from loss of blood to continue. End of chapter 17. Chapter 18 of The Bandit of Hell's Bend by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 18. Through the Night. In a back room of the Chicago Saloon, Thompson sat guard over Hal Colby, who was neatly and securely trussed and tied to a chair, in which he sat. In the Donovan house, guests were seated at dinner when Gum Smith entered and took his accustomed place. He had just come from the Bar Y, and as the streets of Hendersville had happened to be deserted at the meal hour, he had met no one.
"Hello, Gum," greeted Bill Gatlin. "I reckon you heard me got the Black Coyote."
"I ain't seen no one since I reached town," replied Smith, "but I knowed Colby'd get the critter."
Yet withal, he looked a bit mystified and uneasy.
"Where be he?" he asked.
"He's safe in the Chicago," said Wildcat Bob.
"I reckon I'd better get him over to the jail," said Gum Smith.
"I reckon you'll leave him at the Chicago," replied Wildcat.
"Do you know who he is?"
"Bull, of course."
"Bull, hell. It's Colby." Gum Smith paled, just a trifle.
"There must be some mistake," he said weakly. "Who got him?"
"Bull got him, and they ain't no mistake," said Bill Gatlin. "I knew all along 'twarn't Bull."
"Well," said Gum Smith, "the Chicago saloon ain't no place for a dangerous prisoner. Soon's I've et my vittles, I'll take him over to the jail where he'll be safe."
"I tells you, you'll leave him at the Chicago," said Wildcat Bob.
"I'm sheriff of this here county," bawled Gum Smith, "and nobody don't want to interfere with me in the discharge of my duties. Do y'all hear me, Wildcat Bob?"
"I hears you, but just like a jackass brain, it don't make no impression on my understanding," replied Wildcat,
embellishing his remarks with lurid and descriptive profanity. He finished his meal first and went out. When Gum Smith left the Donovan house, he repaired at once to his own saloon. Here he deputized a half a dozen loafers, gave each of them several drinks, and led them to the Chicago saloon, where he demanded of the proprietor that he turn over to him, forthwith, the person of Hal Colby, otherwise known as the Black Coyote.
"He's in the back room yonder," replied the owner of the Chicago saloon. "If you craves him, go get him. I don't want him."
In front of the door to the back room sat Wildcat Bob. His elbows were resting on his knees, and from each hand dangled a .45.
"In the name of the law," piped Gunsmith in his high voice, "I demands the person of one Hal Colby."
"Get the hell out'n here, you blankety-blank-blank-blank," screamed Wildcat Bob.
"You all better listen to reason, Wildcat Bob," yelled the sheriff, "or I'll have the law on you."
Wildcat Bob, raising his voice yet higher again than that of his ancient enemy, bawled out an incoherent volley of blasphemous and obscene invective. Gum Smith turned and whispered to one of his followers, who withdrew from the room with two others. Presently Gum Smith stepped to one side of the room and, pointing at the little old man sitting before the locked door, called to his remaining deputies, "Take him, men. Do your duty." One of the men stepped forward. Wildcat Bob whirled a gun about his forefinger and, without taking aim, shot the fellow's hat from his head. The three stepped back. Almost simultaneously there came the sound of the crashing of glass from the interior of the room where Colby was confined, the voice of Thompson raised in protest, and then shots. Wildcat Bob leaped to his feet and reached for the knob of the door. As he did so, his back was toward the barroom for an instant, and in that instant, Gum Smith raised his six-shooter and fired. Without a word, Wildcat Bob crumpled to the floor and lay there motionless. Smith and his men leaped for the door. It was locked, and, being a strong door, withstood their combined efforts for several minutes. When at last it gave before their assault and they stepped across the threshold, they saw only the body of Thompson sprawled upon the floor in a pool of blood. The Black Coyote was gone. Surrounded by masked men, her escort shot from his horse. Diana Henders realized only too well the gravity of her situation, and though she recognized no individual among those who had lain in ambush for her, she guessed well enough that they acted under orders from Corson. Her note to him revealing the fact that she knew the entire truth concerning his duplicity and was in possession of the papers that proved it beyond peradventure of a doubt had, she guessed, prompted the desperate adventure in which he pitted all against all. So suddenly had the masked riders come upon them from the bed of a dry wash that they had had them covered before either could draw. Yet Idaho, true to the unwritten code of his calling and his time, had invited death by drawing in the face of their leveled guns in defense of a woman. Had he been alone, or with another man, his hands had gone up the moment he realized that the odds were all against him. And one of them had gone up, but it had carried a six-gun with it, and he had been shot out of his saddle for his chivalry, and left for dead upon the parched ground as his assailants galloped off toward the south with Diana. Night fell, and yet the men kept on, two riding ahead of Diana Henders and four behind. They rode rapidly, not sparing their horses, and from both their haste and the direction of their way the girl guessed that they were making a try for the border. Once in the mountains they were forced to a slower gait, and around 9 o'clock they halted for a brief rest where there was water for both the horses and their riders. At first Diana had attempted to question them relative to their intentions, but they would not tell her where they were taking her, and at last silenced her with oaths and threats. Nor did they remove their masks until darkness equally as well hid their features from her. This and their almost unbroken silence convinced her that her abductors were men who feared recognition and therefore must have been recruited in the neighborhood. A shrewd guess suggested that an habitué of Gum's Place, Liquors and Cigars, would have recognized them all. The abduction had therefore been engineered or at least connived in by the sheriff, and this line of reasoning but corroborated what was already a foregone conclusion that it had been done at Corson's behest. What their purpose with her, she could not guess. It might be but a plan to remove her temporarily to some hidden spot where she might not further interfere with the plans of the New Yorker, or it might easily have a more sinister purpose. She knew that Corson would never be safe in possession of the Barwy property while she lived, and she did not believe that he was fool enough not to appreciate that fact. But would he dare to have her done away with? She wondered. It was after midnight when they crossed the summit at a point where there appeared not the slightest vestige of a trail, and dropped down a dangerous and rocky declivity into a wooded canyon. A dozen times the girl's life was in jeopardy, her only safeguard the agility and sure-footedness of Captain. A half hour later, the canyon widened into a little pocket in the mountains, and here they stopped again. Through the gloom of the deep gorge, her eyes finally distinguished the outlines of a small cabin. The men dismounted. "Get down," said one of them to Diana. And when she had done so, the fellow took her by the arm, with a gruff, "Come along," and led her toward the shack. He pushed open the door and told her to enter. Following behind her, he struck a match, revealing a single room, rudely furnished with a table, a few benches, and a couple of cots, all constructed in rustic fashion from branches of the trees which grew about the place. On the table was a candle holder and a candle, which the men lighted. At one end of the room was a blackened fireplace, above which a long shelf supported a few small boxes and cans. On pegs flanking the fireplace were crude cooking utensils, a frying pan, a stew pan, and a coffee pot, while a larger kettle for heating water squatted in the ashes of the dirty hearth. The other men came in presently. All were masked again. One of them took the kettle and went out, returning shortly with water. Another brought wood, and then a third set about preparing a meal. They had brought some flour and bacon with them. There were baking powder, salt, pepper, and sugar in the cans upon the mantel shelf, together with one of coffee and another of tea. The aroma of cooking food awoke Diana to a realization of the fact that she was hungry. Her situation, while grave, had not as yet reached a point that she might consider dangerous. The attitude of the men had been determined, albeit somewhat nervous, yet never at any time actually menacing. What they had done had evidently been accomplished under orders from some person or persons who were taking no active part in the actual abduction, who were not even present when the thing was done, nor now that they had reached this hiding place in the mountains. Diana Henders was more or less familiar with these southern hills, and she knew that she never had been in this spot before. What an ideal place it would be to commit and effectually hide all traces of a crime. She put such unpleasant thoughts from her, and turned her attention to the bacon sizzling upon the hearth, the while it filled the room with its delicious aroma. She was given a portion of the food, and, seated upon one of the rude cots, devoured it ravenously. Her fears, of whatever magnitude they might be, had not spoiled her appetite, nor did she show in any outward manner that she was afraid, either of her abductors or contemplation of the fate that awaited her. The meal over, one of the men arose and left the cabin. From the monosyllabic conversation that ensued, she gathered that he had been sent back along their route to a point where he could act as sentinel and thus safeguard them from surprise. They did not appear to expect pursuit, but took this precaution, evidently in accordance with orders previously received, or a plan prearranged. After the meal, the men smoked for a while, and then, one by one, lay down upon the rough boards to sleep, so disposing themselves that the girl could not approach either the door or the single window without disturbing one or more of them. The last man blew out the candle before he lay down. Diana Henders stretched herself at length upon the rough branches that formed the bottom of one of the cots and tried to sleep. How long she lay awake she did not know, but eventually she fell into a light slumber, from which she was awakened about 3 a.m. by the sound of horses' feet on the ground outside the cabin. Then she heard men's voice speaking in subdued tones. A sudden premonition seized her. Rescue was at hand. She heard the door open, and immediately 2 of the men upon the floor awoke and sat up. "Who's that?" demanded one. "Me," replied one of the newcomers. "The rest of you fellers wake up. We gotta get out of here." He stepped to the table, struck a match, and lighted the candle. In its first flare, Diana recognized his figure as that of the man who had gone out after the meal to act as guard along the trail. The man with him was Hal Colby. "Put out that light, you damn fool," cried one of the wakened sleepers. "Do you want this girl to recognize us all?" The light went out quickly. Hal Colby stepped across the room to her side. "Everything's all right, Di," he said. "I've come for you." The other man was speaking to his fellows. "They's someone on our trail. Colby passed them on the cutoff. He'd been riding behind them for an hour. He says they's 3 of them. We gotta get out." Hastily, the men rose and sought their horses. Colby took Diana by the arm. "Come," he said. "I'll get you out of here." "Why should I want to get out when someone is coming to take me away from these men?" she demanded. "But I'm here. I'll take you out, Di. Come, we must hurry." She shook her head. "No, I shall stay here." "They won't let you. They'll take you along. You had better come with me. I am your friend." "You cannot be a friend of theirs and mine, both." He took her by the arm again. "Come, this is no time for fooling." She struggled to free herself, and when he attempted to drag her forcibly, she struck him in the face with a clenched fist. "You," he cried, applying a vile epithet to her. "You'll come, damn you," and he picked her up and carried her out into the waning night. Most of the men had found their horses and mounted. "Where's your horse?" demanded Colby of one of them, and when it was led forward he threw her roughly into the saddle, and with her own riata he bound her there. Then he mounted his own animal and, leading hers, started down the rough and wooded gorge toward the south. A few miles away, three men drew rein upon a ridge. "We've lost the damn trail again," muttered Texas Pete, sourly. Bull sat erect upon Blazes, his head thrown far back, his nostrils dilated.
"What you looking up yonder for?" demanded Shorty. "The trail that bunch of shorthorns on don't lead to heaven."
"Smell it?" asked Bull.
"What?" "Wood smoke. There's an east wind. Come on."
He rode blindly through the darkness, trusting to the instinct and the eyesight of his horse, toward the east and the fire from which that tenuous suggestion of wood smoke emanated. Where there was fire, there should be man. Thus reasoned Bull. A half hour later, the three slid and rolled with their horses down the steep side of a gorge into a cup-like opening in the hills, and before them, in the growing dawn, they saw a mean, weather-worn shack. From the crumbling chimney, a thin wisp of smoke arose into the still air, to be wafted gently westward after it had topped the summit of the canyon walls. They hid their horses among the trees and the underbrush and crept stealthily toward the building from three sides. Bull was the first to come into the open, and as he did so, he stood erect and sprang toward the doorway of the building, bursting into the interior with two guns ready in his hands. The place was empty. Embers smoldered upon the dirty hearth. A greasy frying pan lay upon the floor at one side, a kettle half filled with warm water upon the other. There was the odor of cigarette smoke in the air of the single room. "They been here, but they's gone," said Bull as his two friends joined him.
"They ain't been gone long," said Shorty.
They found the trail leading down the canyon and followed it, while a few miles ahead Colby and Diana, with the six masked men, debouched upon the wide flat at the foot of the hills. Here they halted.
"One of you fellers swap horses with the girl," commanded Colby, "and then you all circle back to the west and north and hit the high spots for Hendersville. Here, Grift, you take her horse."
"How come?" demanded Grift.
"Why, to lead the folks back at Hendersville off in the trail, of course," replied Colby.
"You'll tell them you found your horse t'other side of the west ranch, and they'll look there till the cows come home."
Grift, satisfied with this explanation, dismounted and took Diana's horse, after which she was bound to the one he had quitted.
"Now beat it," said Colby. "I'll take care of the girl," and he started off toward the south, while the others turned westward.
"I reckon I fooled him," remarked Colby, when the others were out of hearing.
Diana made no reply.
"Them three hombres is trailing you, Di," he continued, "and they'll be just wise enough to follow our captain's tracks. I reckon I fooled 'em fine. Grift never would have swapped horses if he'd a knowed what my reason was."
Diana said nothing. She did not even look at him. They rode on in silence then for some time.
"Look here, Di," he exclaimed finally. "You might as well come down off on your high horse. You're mine now, and I'm going to keep you. As long as I want. I'm rich now. I'll get all the money I wants from Lillian, but you're the one that I love. You're the one I want, and you're the one I'm going to have. After I gets all of Lillian's money, I'll quit her, and you and me'll do some traveling. But in the meantime, I gotta marry her to get the money. Savvy?"
"Cur," muttered Diana, shuddering.
"Well, if you wants to belong to a cur, call me one," he said, laughing. "'Cause you're gonna belong to me after today. You won't never want to go back then. You thought you'd turn me down, did you? You wanted that dirty damn bandit, didn't you? Well, you won't never get him. If he isn't following you with the three that's behind us, he won't never catch up to us this side of the border, and after that he couldn't never find us in 100 years. If he is with them, he'll follow the captain's hoofprints until he catches up with them, and then that bunch of baddens'll shoot him full of holes. I guess maybe I wasn't fooling the whole bunch on him, eh?"
Diana Henders looked her unutterable contempt and loathing. Colby fell silent after a bit, seeing that it was impossible to draw the girl into conversation. Thus they continued on for miles. Suddenly, from far away toward the north, came, just barely audible to their ears, faintly the sound of distant firearms. Bull and his pals had come upon the six. There had been no preliminary, no questions asked. The three had but put spurs to their horses and overtaken the fleeing abductors, who, their work done, had no desire to enter into an argument with anyone. The moment he thought that he was within safe range, Bull had opened up with a single gun, and at the first shot a man had tumbled from his saddle. It was a running fight from then on until but a single one of the six remained. Holding one hand far above his head, he reined in his jaded mount, at the same time letting his gun fall to the ground. Bull drew up beside him.
"Where's Miss Henders?" he demanded.
"I don't know nothing about her. I ain't seen her."
"You lie," said Bull, in a low voice. "You're riding her horse now. Where is she? I'll give you 5 seconds to answer before I send you to hell."
"Colby taking her, south, toward the border," cried Grift,
and Bull wondered, for he had left the man safely in Hendersville.
"You take that horse home, Grift," said Bull, "to the Bar Y. If you've lied to me about Miss Henders, or if that horse ain't in a Bar Y corral when I gets back, I bore you. Savvy?"
Grift nodded.
"Now beat it," said Bull, and reined about toward the south.
Again the hard, pitiless grind commenced. Beneath a scorching sun, over blistering alkali flats, the three urged their weary horses on.
"You gotta make it, Blazes, you gotta make it," whispered Bull in the ear of his pony.
"She can't be much ahead, and there ain't nothing can step away from me and you, Blazes, forever. We'll catch up with him someday."
End of chapter 18. Chapter 19 of The Bandit of Hell's Bend by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 19. Tell Me That You Love Me. It was 10 o'clock that morning before Bull, Texas Pete, and Shorty picked up Coley's trail, and by that time the man and his unwilling companion were a good 4 hours ahead of them. On tired horses, through the heat of a blazing Arizona day, it seemed hopeless to expect to overhaul their quarry before night had fallen, and by that time Colby would have crossed the border. Not, however, that that meant much to the three who pursued him, to whom international boundary lines were of no more practical import than parallels of latitude or isothermal lines. Before noon, they were obliged to stop and rest their horses at a waterhole that afforded a brackish but refreshing drink for the three jaded animals. In the mud at its border, they saw the fresh tracks of Colby's pony and Diana's. It was evident that they had stopped here for a considerable time, which, in truth, they had. So positive was Colby that he had thrown their pursuers off the track, leading them into a gunfight with a superior force that might reasonably have been expected to have accounted for them to the last man. 5 minutes was all the rest that the pursuers allowed their horses. Once again they were in the saddle. "Looky yonder," exclaimed Texas Pete, pointing toward the south. "If it ain't raining there, I'm a seawash." "It's about a month too early for the rains," said Bull, "but it sure is raining. Raining like hell. Look at that lightning. Say, if they ain't crossed Saley's flats yet, they won't never get across. Not while the rain lasts." "And if they has crossed, we won't never catch 'em," said Shorty. "I'll catch 'em if I have to ride plumb to hell and if it takes me 100 years, said Bull. The rain struck Colby and Diana at the northern edge of the flats. It came in driving sheets and sometimes in solid masses that almost crushed them. It came with deafening reverberations of titanic thunder and vivid, almost terrifying displays of lightning. It was bad where they were, but Colby knew from experience of the country that in the low hills at the upper end of the flats it was infinitely worse, that there had been a cloudburst. He put spurs to his horse and, dragging Diana's into a gallop, urged them both to greater speed, knowing that if he did not cross the wash in the center of the flats within a few minutes, he might not cross it again for days. When they reached it, 3 feet of turbid water tumbled madly down the narrow bed between the precipitous clay walls. The man found a steep path that stock had made for crossing when the bed of the wash was dry, and urged his horse downward. The force of the current almost swept the animal from its feet, but with widespread legs it stemmed the torrent, while Colby, taking a few turns of the lead rope around his horn, dragged Diana's pony through in safety after him. At the top of the bank, the man turned and looked towards the north and then down at the rising flood. "If this rain holds out, they won't nothing more cross here for a spell," he said, smiling. "In 10 minutes she'll be plumb full. We can take it easier now." He started off again, but now at a walk, for he knew that there was no longer need for haste, if there had been before, which he had doubted. The horses, cooled and refreshed by the rain, would have been equal to a spurt now, but none was necessary. And so they came after a mile to the dim outlines of an adobe house showing through the driving downpour directly ahead. Colby rode close up to the door and, leaning from his saddle, pounded upon it. There was no reply. "I reckon we'll stop here a while," he said, dismounting. He opened the door and looked in. The place was deserted. In rear of it was an open shed for stock, and to this they rode. Colby helped Diana from her horse, removed the saddles and bridles from the animals, and tied them beneath the shed. Then he led the girl to the house, her arms still bound by her riata. There was no chance that she could escape now, so the man removed her bonds. "We'll rest here a few hours and give the horses a chance, then we'll hit the trail. We gotta find a place where we can feed. My belly's wrapped around my backbone."
"Let's be friends, Di. You might as well make the best of it. You can't blame a feller for loving you, and I ain't so bad. You might have done a lot worse."
He came toward her and raised his hand as though to place it on her arm.
"Don't touch me."
She drew back with an appreciable shudder of revulsion. He laughed. "You'll feel better after a while," he said.
"We're both too dog-tired to be very good company. I'm going to get in a little sleep. You'd better do the same, but I'll have to tie you up again unless you promise not to try to escape." She made no reply. "All right," he said, "if you'd rather be tied." He came then and tied her hands behind her. Keeping one end of the rope in his own hand, he lay down upon the dirt floor and was soon asleep. Diana sat with her back against the wall, listening to the rain beating upon the roof and driving against the walls. The roof leaked badly in several places, and the water that came through formed puddles on the floor which joined together into a little rivulet that wound to the doorway and disappeared beneath the door. How hopeless! Diana stifled a sob. She was tired and hungry and weak from exhaustion. The frightful rain had cut off the frail vestige of the chance of rescue that there had been before. By now no man or beast could cross Saley's flats. She knew one man who would try, had he known of her predicament, but how was he to know of it, a hunted fugitive hiding in the mountains far to the north? Realizing the necessity for haste if they were to cross the flats before the wash became an impassable torrent, the three pursuers drove their tired horses onward at the top of their diminished speed. The race became at once a test for the survival of the fittest, and Blazes forged steadily farther and farther ahead of the other ponies. Long before Bull reached the flats, the rain was upon him, refreshing both horse and man, and Blazes, as though imbued with new life,
increased the distance between himself and the two ponies now far behind. The driving rain was rapidly obliterating the trail that the man followed, yet he managed to cling to it to the very brink of the wash, to the very point where Colby and Diana had crossed, and there Bull drew rein to look down, scowling, upon a seething barrier of yellow water. 20 feet wide it was, and 10 feet deep, swirling and boiling like a cauldron of hell. He eyed the greasy, muddy footing of the bank. Had it been firm and dry, he had put Blazes to it for a jump, but he knew that it could not be done now, nor could he swim the horse. Even could the animal have made the crossing, it could not have clambered out upon the top of that perpendicular, constantly caving wall, with the mighty current always dragging at it. But Bull was not hopeless. He was merely devising ways and means. Not for an instant had he considered the possibility of giving up the pursuit, or even of delaying it by waiting for the waters to recede. Taking his rope in his hand, he dismounted and stepped close to the brink of the torrent, upon both sides of which grew numerous clumps of greasewood. He seemed already to have formed a plan, for he drew one of 6 guns and hurled it across the wash. He followed it with a 2nd gun and then his heavy belt of cartridges. Then came his boots, one by one. Shaking down the Honda, he swung a noose at the end of his rope, which, opening up, descried a circle that seemed to revolve around his head at an angle of 45 degrees of the ground, like a rakish halo, just for an instant, and then it rose and sailed gracefully across the newborn river to drop around a clump of greasewood upon the opposite bank. "Come here," said Bull to Blazes, and the horse stepped to his side, close to the water's edge. "Stand," commanded Bull, knowing that Blazes would stand where he was for hours, if necessary, until his master gave a new order. Bull drew in his rope until it became taut, and then he dragged heavily upon the greasewood across the channel. It held, despite his most strenuous efforts. He tied the loose end about his waist, stepped to the very edge of the water, and leaped in. Hal Colby awoke and looked about him. His eyes fell upon the girl sitting with her back against the wall across the room. "Feeling better?" he asked. "I am. Nothing like sleep, unless it be grub." She did not reply. He rose to his feet and approached her. "You're sure a sullen little devil, but I'll take that out of you. A little lovin'll do that. Get up and kiss me."
"You unspeakable thing. It would be an insult to a cur to call you that."
Colby laughed good-naturedly. "If you'd rather have a bandit, I might turn one," he said, and again he laughed, this time at his own joke. "But if you are trying to suggest that I would prefer Bull, you are right. You may thank God that he is not here, but he will come, and you will pay."
"Well, you ain't got up and kissed me yet," said Colby. "Do you want me to yank you up? You got a lot to learn, and I am the hombre's what can learn you."
"I've had a lot of experience. I've tamed him before, as good as you. Tamed him and made him like it. If it can't be did one way, it can another. Sometimes a quirt helps." He struck his chaps with the lash of the one he carried. "Get up, you." He seized her by the arm and jerked her roughly to her feet. Again she struck him, and this time the man struck back, a stinging blow across her shoulders with the quirt.
"I'll learn you," he cried.
She tried to free herself, striking him repeatedly, but he held her off and lashed her cruelly, nor did he appear to care where the quirt fell. The tumbling waters, engulfing Bull, rolled him over and over before, half-drowned, his powerful strokes succeeded in raising his head above the surface. He had had no conception of the tremendous strength of the current. He was but as a bobbing bit of flotsam upon its surface. He could not stem it. He was helpless. The rope about his waist suddenly tautened, and he was again dragged beneath the surface. He grasped it with his hands and tried to pull himself in toward shore, but the giant waters held him in their grip, dragging him downward, stronger by far than the strength of many men. Suddenly the muddy flood spewed him to the surface once more, this time against the bank to which the opposite end of his rope was fastened and was dragging heavily upon its precarious anchor. He clutched at the slippery red mud, clawing frantically for a handhold. The waters leaped upon him and beat him down, but still he fought on valiantly, not for his life but for the girl he loved, and at last he won, dragging himself slowly out upon the bank. Almost exhausted, he rose, staggering, to his feet, and looked back across the torrent at Blazes. "It ain't no use, boy," he said, with a shake of his head. "I was a-going to rope you and drag you across, but it can't be did. Now I reckon I'll have to hoof it." He sat down in the mud and pulled on his boots, gathered up his guns and belt, coiled his rope, and turned his face southward.
"If it takes 100 years and I have to follow him plumb to hell," he muttered, "I'll get him."
Still spent and blowing from his tremendous exertions against the flood, he staggered on through the sticky clay and the blinding rain, his head bent down against the storm. It was hard work, but never once did the thought of surrender enter his mind. He would find a ranch house somewhere and get a horse. He might even come upon some range stock. He had his lariat, and there was a bare chance that he might get close enough to an animal to rope it, but he must have a horse. He felt helpless, entirely impotent without one. Imagine yourself thrust into a cold and unfriendly world, if you are a man, without a pocket knife, a bunch of keys, a handkerchief, money, or a pair of shoes, and you will be able to appreciate how a cowboy feels without a horse. Thus, buffeted by the storm, he shouldered on until suddenly there loomed almost directly in his path the outlines of an adobe house. Fortune smiled upon him. Here he would find a horse.
He stepped to the door and was about to knock when he heard the voice of a woman crying out in protestation and pain. Then he flung the door wide and stepped into the interior. Colby, holding Diana's wrist, was twisting it in an excess of rage, for she had struck him and repulsed him until the last vestige of his thin veneer of manhood had fallen from him, leaving exposed the raw, primordial beast. He saw Bull the instant that the latter opened the door, and, swinging the girl in front of him, reached for a gun. Diana, too, saw the figure in the doorway. A great wave of joy swept through her, and then she saw Colby's gun flash from its holster and knew that Bull could not shoot because of fear of hitting her. But she did not know Bull as well as she thought she knew him, and similarly was Colby deceived, for the man in the doorway fired from the hip the instant that Colby's gun was raised. The weapon fell from nerveless fingers, the grasp upon Diana's wrist relaxed, and Hal Colby pitched forward upon his face, a bullet hole between his eyes. Diana swayed for an instant, dazed by the wonder of her deliverance, and then, as Bull stepped toward her, she went to meet him and put her arms about his neck. "Bull!" It was half a sob. The man took her in his arms. "Diana!" The word carried all the reverence of a benediction. Raising her face from his shoulder, she pushed him away a little. "Bull," she said, "once you told me that you loved me. Tell me so again." "Love don't tell the half of it, girl," he said, his voice husky with emotion. "Oh, Bull," she cried, "I have been such a fool. I love you. I have always loved you, but I did not know it until that night, the night they came after you at the West Ranch." "But you couldn't love me, Diana, thinking I was the Black Coyote." "I don't care, Bull, what you are. All I care or know is that you are my man. We will go away together and start over again. Will you, Bull, for my sake?" And then he told her that he didn't have to go away, told her who the Black Coyote had been. "Why, he even planted one of the bullion sacks under my bedroll at the West Ranch to prove I was the right hombre," said Bull. "Saw a sack of dust I brung from Idaho, and he tried to make him think it was yours. He used to send me off alone the days he was going to hold up the stage, so as when the time was ripe he could throw suspicion on me. He sure was a clever fellow, Hal was." "But the day Mac was wounded," she asked, "we saw you coming in from the north, and there was blood on your shirt." "I got in a brush with Apaches up Cottonwood, me and Gregorio, and I got scratched. 'Twasn't nothing." "And to think that all that time he was professing friendship for you, he was trying to make me believe that you were the Black Coyote," cried Diana. "He was worse than Mr. Corson, and I thought him about the wickedest man I had ever known." "We got to think about getting back and having a friendly powwow with that there Corson gent," said Bull. "By golly, the sun's out. Everything's happy, Diana, now that you're safe." They walked to the doorway. The rain had stopped as suddenly as it had begun, and now the fierce sun blazed down upon the streaming mud. "Where's your horses?" asked Bull. "In a shed behind the house." "Good, we'll start along. There's a bridge 25 miles below here, if I ain't mistaken. I think I know this here shack. I was down this way 2 years ago."
"But what about him?" She nodded back toward the body of Colby. "He can rot here for all I care," said Bull, bitterly. "A hurtin' you? God, I wish he'd had 9 lives like a cat so I could kill him a few more times." She closed the door behind them. "We'll have to notify Gum Smith so they can send down and bury him."
"Gum Smith won't never get the chance," he said.
They walked to the shed, and he saddled the 2 horses, rested now and refreshed a little by the past hours of relief from the heat. And after they had mounted and ridden halfway to the wash, they saw the figures of 2 men upon the opposite bank. "Texas Pete and Shorty," he told her. They recognized the girl and Bull, and whooped and shouted in the exuberance of youth and joy. It was a hard ride to the bridge through the heavy mud, but it was made at last, and then the 4 joined upon the same side and set out toward home, picking up Idaho en route, still weak, but able to sit a horse. It was 2 days later before they rode into the Barwy ranch yard, where they were met with wild acclaim by Willie, Wong, and the men's cook.
"Where's Corson?" demanded Bull. "The whole bunch has gone to town to close the deal. There was some hitch the other day. Wong said he heard him talking. Corson wouldn't take nothing but gold, and Wainwright had to send up to Aldea for it. They say it's coming in on today's stage."
"I'm going to town," announced Bull.
"So am I," said Diana.
"We'll all go," said Shorty.
"Get us up some fresh horses, Willie," said Texas Pete. Then he turned to Diana. "You ain't said yet that I ain't foreman no more."
They both smiled.
"Not yet, Pete. I'll have to talk it over with Bull," said Diana.
Remounted, they galloped off toward Hendersville, all but Idaho. Him they left behind, much to his disgust, for he needed rest. They reached town 30 minutes after the stage had pulled in, and entering the Donovan house, found Corson, Lillian Mantle, the 2 Wainwrights, together with the attorney from Aldea and Gum Smith. At sight of Bull, Gum Smith leaped to his feet.
"Yo all's under arrest," he squealed.
"What fur?" asked Bull.
"For robbing the United States mail, that's what fur."
"Hold your horses, Gum," admonished Bull. "I ain't quite ready for you yet. I craves conversation with these here dudes first."
He turned to the elder Wainwright.
"You was honin' to pay $125,000 to this here dude for the Bar Y?"
"'Tain't none of your business," snapped Wainwright.
Bull laid a hand upon the butt of one of his guns.
"Does I have to run you out of Hendersville to get a civil answer?" he demanded.
Wainwright paled. "I've paid already, and the Bar Y is mine," he answered, surlily.
You've been stung. Them two's crooks.
The girl ain't no relation to Miss Hender's uncle, and we've got the papers to prove it. We got the will, too, that this skunk tried to get hold of and destroy.
Leastwise, Miss Hender's had him, but she sent him to Kansas City before Corson could get hold of him. Texas Pete here took him to Aldea. That's why you didn't find him in the office, Corson, when you robbed the safe. Wong saw you and told us about it just before we left the ranch today. All you got was the copies she made. I don't wonder you wanted gold from Wainwright.
He's lying, cried Corson to Wainwright. Do you believe what a fellow like he is says? Why, he'll be in a federal penitentiary inside of another month for robbing the mail. There isn't a jury on earth would take his word for anything.
I ain't there yet, and no more I don't expect to be, said Bull.
You all's under arrest, just the same, right now, cried Gumsmith, and I warned you to come along peaceable-like with me.
Now I'm coming to you, Gum, said Bull. You better beat it, Gum. You ain't worth shooting with cartridges the price they be, he continued.
Gregorio has told me the whole story. He's going straight now, and he wants to square himself. He's writ out and signed a confession that's going to make this climate bad for your rheumatism.
Gregorio is a dirty lying greaser, screamed Gum. They won't know and believe him neither. They ain't no one got the goods on me.
No, said Bull, but you have. Nearly every ounce of that gold, except what you and Colby spent and what little you give Gregorio, is buried underneath the floor in the back room of your saloon.
And me and Pete and Shorty's right here to see that no hombre don't get it what don't belong to it.
Gumsmith paled.
Tain't so. It's a damn lie.
That's the second time I've been called a liar in 5 minutes, said Bull. I ain't did nothing because they's ladies present, but I'm going to send them out in the room in a minute, and then we'll talk about that, if you're still here. I advise you not to be, though. Wainwright, I seen your buckboard tied out in front here.
By crowding, it'll hold 5, meaning you, that ornery-looking dude son of yourn, Corson, Miss Mantle, and Gum. You all be in it and hitting the trail north for t'other side of the hill inside of 5 minutes, or me and the boys is going to start shooting. On the way, Wainwright, you and Corson can settle that little matter of the 125,000. If you can get it back from him, tain't nothing to me. But if you don't, you deserve to lose it, for you're just as big a thief as he is, only not quite so bright in the head. Now get, and get damn pronto.
His voice had suddenly changed from mocking irony to grim earnestness. It was a savage voice that uttered the final command. Gumsmith was the first out of the room. He was followed by the others.
See him to the edge of town, boys, and see that they don't linger, said Bull to Shorty and Texas Pete.
Oh, mama, exclaimed Shorty. Lead me to them funny pants.
Bull turned to the attorney from Aldea. I ain't got no proof that you were in on this deal, he said, so you can wait and go on the stage tomorrow.
Thanks, said the attorney. No, I thought it was a perfectly legitimate transaction, but I am glad they called me down, for now perhaps I can transact some real business for some other clients of mine. I had not been aware that the Bar Y was for sale, or I had been over here before.
I represent a large syndicate of Eastern Packers, whom I know would be interested in this property, and if Miss Henders will make me a proposition, I shall be glad to transmit it to them. You will find them very different people to deal with than these others seem to have been.
I thank you, said Diana, but the Bar Y is not for sale.
We are going to run the ranch together, aren't we, Bull?
You bet we are, he replied.
Mary Donovan burst from an inner room at that moment.
Bless me heart, she exclaimed, and I never knew you was here till this very minute. And I heard what yous just said, Diana Henders, and I'm not after being such a fool that I don't know what yous means. It makes me that happy, God bless ye. I must be after running in and telling me old man. He'll be that glad, he will.
Your old man, exclaimed Diana.
Sure now, said Mary Donovan, blushing. Didn't yous know that me and Bob was married the day before yesterday? Sure they had to shoot him before I could get him. He never was much, and having a bullet hole clean through him don't make him no better. But then, he's a man, and a poor one's better than none at all.
End of chapter 19. End of The Bandit of Hell's Bend by Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get packs of juicy red, green, black, or tri-color variety seedless grapes for $3.99 each. Then get tender boneless chuck roast or steaks for $4.99 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Allo or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/try.